A cold spring, violet was floored on the lawn. Thank you very much for coming along today, especially if you've trudged and trekked and skidded and swerved. I appreciate it. I'll begin with a few quotes, all taken from Geography 3. Here's the first. Iberia in shape resembles a stretched out hide, its breadth running north to south, the neck pointing east. And the second quote, the same is true of whales of differing shape and size. From their snouts, columns of water are blown out, which to those looking on appear like tall, thin clouds. And the third, in countries by the ocean, the sun appears larger as it sets and makes a sound like hot metal in a cold trough, as though the sea hisses when the sun is plunged into its depths. Apologies to Elizabeth Bishop aficionados ransacking their mental files and folders of poems. The quotes are actually taken from the third book of the Geographica by Greek traveller and author Strabo, rather than from the American poet's 1976 collection of the same name. Apologies also for the crude translations and for inserting line breaks into the work of an ancient and venerable prose writer. There is a method in my misdirection, which I believe goes beyond the coincidence of a shared volume title. Like Strabo, Bishop was a geographer. She even wrote a travel book about Brazil, though chose not to remember much about it. And typically, a geographer of the page rather than the planet, a describer rather than an explorer. Someone who had undoubtedly journeyed, but whose expeditions were principally those of curiosity and inventiveness, extensions of fancy and association that propelled her beyond the circumscribed boundaries and borders of lived experience into more metaphysical and imagined territories. I was always a sort of guest, Bishop said, talking about her relationships with her relatives and carers, but commenting by extension on the places where she was required to live and the locations in which she found herself. Bishop's poem, The Map, occupies page one of her 1946 debut collection, North and South, and represents, therefore, something of a poetic embarkation. The last line, more delicate than the historians are the map maker's colours, disclosing from the outset the poet's fragile investment in a personalised and customised world. And in many of her best pieces, poetry wells up out of a form of journal making or note-taking, a through-the-porthole view of the planet, where the glass of the window will eventually serve as a lens, focusing on some peculiar or particular detail that catches her eye. Dozens of her poems follow this arrangement, but the title poem from 1965's Questions of Travel is a useful example for all kinds of reasons. It begins, there are too many waterfalls here. The crowded streams hurry too rapidly down to the sea, and the pressure of so many clouds on the mountaintops makes them spill over the sides in soft, slow motion, turning to waterfalls under our very eyes. This kind of subjective travelogue could be straight out of Strabo or one of his kind. The guided tour leading to a reflective conclusion, in this case, a golden silence that follows rain. A silence gilded by sunlight, we suppose. A period of illumination in which the poet picks up her pen and writes the poem we have been reading. It also explains Bishop's fascination with Darwin, given the scientist's propensity to slide away from facts and sink giddily into the unknown, as well as his obvious relish for the exhilaration and the excitement of the journey. A Galapagos of foreign lands and unusual creatures are often waiting to be encountered at the end of Bishop's poems, at which point Darwin is usually relieved of the tiller and Freud or Jung are caught to the helm. We are driving to the interior, Bishop concludes in Arrival at Santos. Returning to Strabo, the loquacious old geographer had an endearing partiality for metaphor, often expressed as resemblances, explaining the alien and exotic through comparisons with the recognized and understood, as in the quoted example in which the sun sets off the Spanish or Portuguese coast like hot metal in a blacksmith's bucket. Strabo is actually quoting Posidonius at this point and doubting the veracity of the senior man's observations, though in repeating the metaphor in full, he seems to understand how satisfying the image will be to a reader and is happy to bask in its reflected glory. Bishop is equally, if not more, partial to such resemblances. In the aforementioned questions of travel, the aforementioned mountaintops look like the hulls of capsized ships, slime-hung and barnacled. And the aforementioned golden silence follows a rain that is, like politicians' speeches, 2 hours of unrelenting oratory. These are not isolated or random examples. Most of Bishop's poems include at least one direct comparison, sometimes several, and a use of the word like as the conductive interface in such mimetic equations between what I.A. Richards termed the tenor and the vehicle is worthy of closer scrutiny. So as well as thinking about Bishop's poetry through her use of simile, it's also my intention to use her work as a way of thinking about the use and value of poetic analogy. If there can be such a person as the darling of poetry, that person is currently Elizabeth Bishop. Darling, I accept, is a somewhat patronizing term, but I use it as a means of characterizing the degree of fondness that has developed around her work. As a poet, she's often cherished and has achieved the billing that publicists, marketing departments, and blurb writers prize above all others. She is beloved. It's the kind of near universal approval that led a mischievous Michael Hoffman, reviewing the Chatto edition of her poems in 2011, to feel stirrings of a wholly impersonal desire, maybe to pan her, an urge he ultimately resisted. Yet Bishop's semi-untouchable status can be seen as something of a conundrum, because while her poetry subtly captured or even anticipated urgent literary themes of gender politics and sexual orientation, hers is, on occasions, a traditional and an orthodox art. By which I mean, she is at times an old school rhymer and versifier, a romantic, a poet who dabbles in homespun wisdom, and someone who, now and again, will offer some fairly queasy perspectives on others and otherness. She's also, here and there, a poet of simple diction, conservative syntax, conventional line breaks, and sequential logic. An approachable and relatable writer whose work can be read straight off the page and understood by almost anyone with a reasonable grasp of the English language. She is not Wallis Stevens, and nearly 40 years after her death, her occasionally engaging and endearing tones seem conspicuously at odds with the stringencies and detachments that often typify contemporary poetry. That her readability and her profundity should be considered a contradiction might seem odd to the uninitiated, but these days, obscurity rather than subtlety is more readily associated with deep thinking and serious poetic intent, especially within a scholarly environment. So it's by no means a given that Bishop's star should be so high in the sky, especially over the American campus. For such a highly regarded poet within an essentially academic territory, her work is unusually cooperative. Not that her approach has always found a favourable reception. A. Alvarez, in his 1957 Kenyan Review piece on her second book, accused Miss Bishop, as she is referred to throughout, of mere-mannered fussy prattling, of hesitant involution, of possessing a finicky air, and of having no style at all, only a tone. Of her imagery, he opined, her similes are often charming, sometimes extraordinary, but very rarely are they absolutely necessary. Her interest in Darwin is also an affiliation that some critics have levelled against her, the association making her the Victorian specimen collector or natural historian, rather than the abstract theoretician or radical experimenter in language that the mid-20th century might have expected and produced. So what kind of poetry are we talking about? What is the nature of this work that commands so much attention from so many admirers, myself included? In reading through a poet's entire output, it's a habit of mine, a bad habit, probably, to try and pick out a manifesto piece, a poem whose every aspect seems to fly the colours for the whole of their writing, or which offers little resistance to the imposition of such a reading. For Bishop, I might elect the short poem Late Air, and not simply because it fits neatly into the frame of a PowerPoint slide. From a magician's midnight sleeve, the radio singers distribute all their love songs over the dew-wet lawns. And like a fortune teller's, their marrow-piercing guesses are whatever you believe. But on the Navy Yard aerial I find better witnesses for love on summer nights. Five remote red lights keep their nests there, phoenixes burning quietly where the dew cannot climb. It's a slight poem, as it occasionally admits. Slight in its extent, in the clumsy contraction radio singers, as if they were an actual thing, in its awkward reliance on the rather mechanical distribute, or more possible, distribute, even if that verb does manage to convey a sense of commercial promulgation. And slight for the phrase, for love on summer nights, a line more worthy of the popular music she defines in stanza one than the alternative to that music proposed in stanza two, within which the line incongruously appears. But as a poem, it's aware of its shortcomings, makes something of a virtue of them, in fact. On one level, going through the motions of organised verse, but using that as a cover for more nuanced and deceptive point-making, distracting with one hand while stealing, conjuring, and practising little acts of legerdemain with the other. We find this in the camouflaged rhyme scheme, and even in the poem's title, two small everyday single syllables that mask more covert meanings. Air as the breathable atmosphere, but also the medium through which the radio waves are broadcast, and the old-fashioned word for a song, both the literal song of the transmission and the song of the poem itself, set down in lyric form. Late ostensibly gives the poem an evening setting, but also includes a sense of belatedness. The mid-20th century is late in poetry's evolutionary history to be using a style and shape we might more readily associate with a poet like Thomas Hardy. But that's what she's going to do, and she admits to the nostalgia. The indents are especially Hardy-esque. The poem's structured as a kind of call and response with the self, or perhaps with the soul. Bishop setting out a premise in one stanza, which she will go on to dispute in the next. Some people, she implies, will fall for the sentimentality of recorded music and pin their romantic hopes on its schmaltzy messages. The dew-wet lawns are pretty much dewy-eyed with moisture. Bishop, though, will lift her sight above those lawns and stare more clear-sightedly towards the mast standing in the Navy Yard, those mundane and mechanical protuberances by which the broadcast is delivered. At the same time, Bishop isn't promoting science over sentiment or steeling herself against the irrationalities of love. Rather, she locates love's symbols in less obvious locations. If there is an expression of romance to be identified this evening, it will be determined by the imagination of the poet and will be offered in poetic terms. So while the five-syllable line, "Five remote red lights," is delivered with technical precision and uncluttered intelligence, the poet's mind is about to transform those lights into nests, and nests of that mythical bird, the phoenix. Phoenixes which tonight are not mere observers but witnesses, complicit through their presence, expert in their validation of the scene, yet silent in their agreement. "Only I have noticed this," the poet seems to be saying, hinting at forbidden passions beyond the remit of the traditional girl meets boy love song, and at erotic desires that lie outside the ordinary. Furthermore, the poet seems alone. One mention of you in the first verse, one mention of I in the second, separated by a stanza break which divides two self-contained and somewhat opposed units of thought and speech. That place where the dew cannot climb is an envied and elevated position, but also one of isolation or even impossibility. Below the tune, a melancholy undertone is playing. Imagery in poetry is an annoyingly or usefully vague term, covering everything from the overarching allegorical significance of an entire epic poem, to figures of speech, to the specific correlation between one value and another, which might even be expressed in a single word, as when Milton describes Adam and Eve as being imparadised in one another's arms, as the devil looks on jealously. For the sake of simplicity, my own practice has been to divide the larger category of imagery into three subsets in a descending scale. At the top end, the image of the third magnitude, we have the conceit, both Petrarchan and metaphysical, in which a surface comparison parallels a poem's inferred subtext from beginning to end. Donne's The Flea or Herbert's The Pulley are obvious examples, but the idea could be applied to far longer and wider-ranging texts. Homer's Odyssey as a conceit for the human lifespan. Sir Gawain and the Green Knight as a conceit for youthful conceitedness, and so on. Second magnitude imagery in my classification system covers the use of metaphor where component parts are not so much compared as confidently offered as the same thing. "You are our father, we are the clay, and you are potter." Isaiah 64:8. And first magnitude imagery, your entry-level mimetic, if you will, is represented by the simile, again, a vexed and contested term, but via my simplification, a linguistic configuration in which the word "as," or more usually "like," is utilized, acknowledging that a comparison or equivalence is being proposed. Though for all its apparent forthrightness, a simile doesn't usually stand up to too much logical prodding and probing. Take as example Eliot's famous "When the evening is spread out against the sky like a patient etherized upon a table." In literal terms, the evening is not a place but a time, yet somehow it must assume spatial dimensions to enable it to stand as foreground to the physical entity of the sky. And all this before the real business of the simile, which requires the evening to be a patient and the sky to be an operating table, with the former upon the latter, as opposed to being spread out against it, as the two referents were in their original relationship. Yet for all its contrivance and unreasonableness, Eliot's opening gambit to Prufrock remains one of the most memorable similes of 20th century poetry, being satisfying at an instinctive level, as well as announcing the themes of the poem and its attendant linguistic registers, as if we have experienced it as much as comprehended it. And despite their nut and bolt constructions, what makes similes more profound than metaphors on occasions is the idea that a likeness is an expression of approximation, allowing for or even insisting upon the possibility of unlikeness. Justifications for using imagery in poetry range from the exalted to the parochial. Towards the higher end of the argument, we encounter Milton again and Paradise Lost again, not only the greatest standalone poetic achievement in the English language, but something of a textbook of critical theory, should we read it by that candle. In Book 5, charged by God with cautioning Adam about his impending fall and aware of the limitations of the human mind, the archangel Raphael begins, "What surmounts the reach of human sense, I shall delineate so, by likening spiritual to corporal forms, as may express them best. Though what if earth be but a shadow of heaven, and things therein, each to other like, more than on earth is thought." So right from the outset, the simile is a method of justifying the ways of God to man. And since mankind is made in God's image anyway, we are but a living metaphor, and metaphor making a function of our very existence. At the more earthbound end of the practice, images can be thought of as a form of inclusiveness and sharing, or as a shorthand to reason, or as a way of showing off, and even as a bit of fun. The simile and the smile have much in common. Hey, poets, remember when poetry was fun? No, thought not. At this point in the movie version of this lecture, tumbleweed rolls through an empty street and a crow lands on the cemetery gates. Arguments against the use of imagery, and particularly simile in poetry, include the following: that it closes down rather than opens up possibility, reducing interpretation to a fixed and, in any case, fabricated analogy; that it is a canonical device and therefore a chauvinistic strategy, promoting disproved and disapproved of hierarchies of language, philosophy, and literature; that it has no special meaning beyond the literal; that in its extreme or isolated form, it is mere ornament or decoration, a criticism leveled at so-called Martian poetry, in which comparison, it was argued, became a pennant and mascot of smug poetic satisfaction; and that there's something cheesy or amateurish about it. Poetry by numbers, lesson one in poetry kindergarten, elementary rather than elemental. "I am crossing the word like out of the dictionary," said Mallarmé, a statement that appeared to condemn metaphor making as old-fashioned and unhelpful. Though for Yorkshire and England fast bowler Fred Truman, it was a newfangled contrivance of the modern era. "We didn't have metaphors in my day," said Fred. "We didn't beat about the bush." Bishop frequently exploits all three magnitudes of imagery as I have defined them, but it's her unstinting use of the rudimentary simile and her predilection for the word like that calls most attention to her taste for analogy. In work published during her lifetime, a modest output comparable to that of Larkin, I have counted, or more probably miscounted, and very probably undercounted, 144 uses of the word like in a metaphorical context. Just to give a quick impression, here's a list of such similes from her first collection, North and South, including the well-known lines, "His shadow dragging like a photographer's cloth behind him," from The Man Moth, and "green hummocks like ancient cannonballs sprouting grass," from Florida. And from The Fish, "the pink swim bladder like a big peony." And here's a nerdy book-by-book breakdown, suggesting that her strike rate of around 1.8 like similes per poem remained true for her from her first volume to her last. And though some of the poems are, of course, simile-free, others are simile-rich, containing as many as five. More subjectively, I would contend that simile is a distinguishing feature of all her most important or famous, or at least regularly anthologized poems. And these statistics don't even take into account similes constructed around the adverbial as, which would increase that strike rate by at least a third. If you're sitting there wondering what kind of sad soul spent the short days of December with the complete poems of Elizabeth Bishop in one hand and an adding machine in the other, wait till you see this next slide, which seeks to categorise her use of simile by type. Of course, you won't be surprised to hear that these results are not the findings of a rigorous scientific investigation. I am a poet. It was Christmas. The door to the drinks cabinet was not always locked. But at some very basic level, I feel that I now have some crude numerical evidence to support what I've always suspected. Namely, that the vast majority of Bishop's similes compare objects with objects by virtue of their visual similarities and tend to do so via a reduction in physical scale. The yellow sun was ugly, like a raw egg on a plate, is the category example I've given here. But by my calculations, there are 59 more where that came from. Add to this her penchant for the words little, 71 uses in 85 poems, small, 35 uses, and tiny, 7 uses, not to mention other terms of diminishment. And reading Bishop can at times feel like being in a chapter of The Borrowers. Like is an especially versatile word in the English language, being verb, adverb, adjective, noun, preposition, and serving several other grammatical functions besides. It's also proved highly adaptable, not to mention controversial, in its current role as a discourse marker or conversational filler within, like, teen speak. Sometimes it's deployed as a stand-in for speech marks, as in, he was like, let's order sushi, and I'm like, dude, we're in Huddersfield. Or as a colon before a physical or facial gesture, or purely as a way of treading water while conversing when previous generations might have ummed and ahed. The fact that like, when used in such a context, has become synonymous with stupidity is partly to do with the airheads and dimwits of big screen and small to whom such verbal mannerisms are assigned, and partly because it suggests a person's inability to confidently and accurately describe the world around them. Take this example, overheard only yesterday in a dining establishment not 1,000 miles away from here. Then I got to this like door, and then like opened it. I'm sure it came from the mouth of a highly intelligent being, but nevertheless, it gave the irresistible impression of someone who thought that a door might be called a door, but wasn't sure, so just to be on the safe side, likened it to a door, and whose uncertainty about the verb associated with the fundamental operation of such a device led them to compare said operation with itself, just in case. I'm certainly not implying that Bishop is similarly unconfident, though many commentators have noticed the equivocation and prevarication in her work, a tendency to correct herself or cover her tracks within a poem, either by refining a statement or offering supplementary or alternative propositions. In the poem, Under the Window, Auro Preto, typical Bishop facilation and typical Bishop similitude combine. Oil has seeped into the margins of the ditch of standing water and flashes or looks upward brokenly, like bits of mirror, no, more blue than that, like tatters of the morpho butterfly. Of course, in Bishop's case, the indecision is deliberate, a technique, yet the effect is one of tentativeness or even naivety, not out of keeping with the childlike frankness of her similes and their heart-on-the-sleeve willingness to compare one thing with another or to perform a kind of hey presto transformation. This feels especially true when we remember how many of Bishop's similes represent reductions in dimension, big, heavy, or unwieldy things being scaled down to domestic or everyday proportion, as if an attempt were being made to render the bulkier items of this world more manageable and convenient, or even reduce them to models and toys. Added to which, the word like, even in a metaphorical formulation, always carries an echo of its verb form, giving the subconscious impression that the comparison is being enjoyed. Conversely, if we agree with the notion that a simile is only a suggested comparison, and that integral to its conception is the idea that subject and object are as unalike as alike, then the excessive use of simile by Bishop could be construed as evidence of distrust and uncertainty, or of deliberate distortion and oscillation between what is seen and what is imagined. A duality Anne Stevenson, in her early study of Bishop, characterized as the mind and the mirror. I want to look more closely at three Bishop poems, poems that employ similes at some stage in their operation. And using a method that seems appropriate to the subject, I want to explore these poems through comparison with poems by other authors. In class, I found this a useful approach. Students who sometimes struggle to describe a poem in its own terms become more articulate and insightful when a contrast is offered, i.e., when they begin to comprehend what a poem is by noticing what it isn't. I mentioned Thomas Hardy earlier in this lecture, and in an earlier lecture, I mentioned the British and Irish propensity for sketch or scene writing in poems, something I approve of, something Hardy excelled at, and something Bishop practiced over and over. In 1934, Bishop objected to being compared with Hardy, claiming to have read practically none of his poems, though enough to dismiss them as descriptions of funerals or the complaints of seduced milkmaids in Devonshire dialect. By 1965, she's changed her mind enough to describe Hardy's The Self Unseeing as my very favourite, one of his most beautiful little poems, and reports that she is attempting to write her own poem about it. The same year, she's rereading Hardy and admiring his titles, and in 1972, in two of her famous letters admonishing Robert Lowell for his use of private correspondence in his poems, she conscripts Dear Little Hardy into her disapproval, quoting the Wessex man's feelings on a similar abuse. I bring all this to the table as a way of suggesting there's more affiliation between Bishop and Hardy than just the titles of the two poems I'm about to compare. Bishop's In the Waiting Room from Geography 3 and Hardy's In a Waiting Room from his 1917 collection, Moments of Vision. The stage setting of Hardy's poem gives us the dowdy interior of a railway waiting room on a miserable English spring morning. The lugubrious poet, noticing a Bible whose pages have been used somewhat sacrilegiously by a bagman to tally his accounts, and a soldier and wife about to be separated, as they believed, forever. But the glooms lifted by the words of an innocent and enthusiastic child who interprets the posters of fly-blown liners as images of hope and excitement. There's a corniness to the poem. A contemporary cynic might find in its saccharine finale and manipulated sentiment the artistic equivalent of the latest Bruno Mars video or the leaked outline for next year's John Lewis's Christmas advert. But it's crafty as well, and certainly crafted. Hardy's waiting room being a limbo space between an Old Testament England and a world to come. Is one simile making the laughing children both a new dawn and the sacred flame of a more enlightened spirituality? His own presence in the poem, a marginal one and a generous one too. The speaker disappearing into the shadows as the younger generation emerge and shine. And I can't resist the superstitious notion that the child in Hardy's waiting room is reincarnated in Bishop's waiting room, but with the action relocated to a dental practice in Massachusetts, the Bible replaced by a copy of the National Geographic, and the limbo a place of emerging consciousness between a childlike incorruptibility and the dawn of adulthood. The mystery here addressed is that of the existence of the conscience in an insensate universe, said Martin Seymour Smith of Hardy's poem Moments of Vision, and the theme that extends through the collection of the same title. But it can just as convincingly be applied to Bishop's waiting room poem. On this occasion, though, the child speaks for herself, Bishop reminding Hardy, as it were, that adults and the elderly don't own the franchise on anxiety and apprehension. In Bishop's poem, the unstable universe is a personal one. All her coordinates and reference points called into question by the offstage auntie screaming in the dentist's chair and the depictions of imminent cannibalism and erupting volcanoes in a magazine she's turned to for the purpose of distraction. It's from one of those National Geographic photographs that Bishop constructs the poem's only direct simile, which reads, black naked women with necks wound round and round with wire like the necks of light bulbs. It's a disturbing image for a number of reasons, not least for its unacknowledged allusion to the noose. And I mentioned Bishop's occasionally uncomfortable portrayals of the foreign and the strange earlier in the piece. So in the poem Manuelino, for example, and despite occasional mitigating moments of guilt and self-reflection, Bishop's portrait of the servant or handyman of the title consists of a list of complaints and frustrations made by the lady of the house against the untamable native whose children scuttle around her like moles. And it's a similar Elizabeth Bishop whose poem Filling Station begins with the rather prim, oh, but it is dirty, before running the white glove of judgment over the owner's dirty boiler suit, his greasy sons, the grease-impregnated wickerwork, and the dirty dog. All quite thoroughly dirty, she confirms to us, before concluding with the rather patronising platitude, somebody loves us all. Or have I missed the irony? Returning to the National Geographic and Bishop's light bulb moment, I suppose it could be argued that in relating the incident in this way, the poet is being candid about the way the photograph struck her just a few days shy of her 7th birthday. Alternatively, we might feel that in choosing to include such detail while writing as an adult, the simile does Bishop no favours, particularly from where we view it in the early years of the 21st century. True to form, Bishop here is comparing nouns with nouns and comparing bigger nouns with smaller nouns that are domestic and utilitarian, which as comparators only exacerbate the uncomfortable exoticism of the analogy. And for me, the fact that the image is so contrived only adds to the discomfort. The neck of a screw-in light bulb isn't wound with wire at all, but consists of moulded or pressed casing. And our oxymoronic black light bulbs stand in stark contrast to the single simile in Hardy's Waiting Room poem, in which the children are likened to the eastern flame of some high altar. Of Hardy's poems, Larkin once observed, there is a little spinal cord of thought, and each has a little tune of its own. By later life, the tunefulness of Bishop's rhyming and lyricism had largely given way to freer, if not free, verse. But the long, thin anatomy of In the Waiting Room and the irregular vertebrae of its stanzas could be thought of as a form of Darwinian adaptation. On that front, it's also interesting to consider that the events being described in both waiting rooms on either side of the Atlantic could be occurring almost simultaneously. Hardy's poem appeared in book form the year before the end of World War I, and Bishop's poem ends, "Then I was back in it. The war was on. Outside in Worcester, Massachusetts, were night and slush and cold. And it was still the 5th of February, 1918. I don't think Bishop could ever be convincingly described as a war poet, but at some level, 20th century conflicts are surely present in the symbolism of her poem, The Armadillo, a poem eventually collected in Questions of Travel with a backdated dedication to Robert Lowell, but which had first been published 8 years earlier in The New Yorker. Apologies for this slide, by the way. I thought it was being clever when I assembled it, but now realise it looks like the odd one out round on Have I Got News For You? Lowell cited the armadillo not only as the style model for his signature poem Skunk Hour, dedicated to Bishop, but also as the irrigating element which ended a barren period of creativity and the pivot by which he turned from the rhyme-heavy, densely woven verse of his first three collections to the more languid forms and confessional attitudes of life studies and the poems for which he's now remembered. Bishop and Lowell's bond was a marriage consummated by correspondence, an epistolary relationship to rival that between two poets of any era. It was a conversation which flowed through the work as well, though despite Lowell's acknowledgement of debt, on the face of it, there's a striking lack of similarity between The Armadillo and Skunk Hour. The former composed of rhyming quatrains, several lines conforming to or falling into regular iambic tetrameter, the latter being an apparently looser composition of six-line stanzas, the lines varying in their length, their syllable count, and their stress count, the stanzas utilizing occasional but irregular rhyme, mostly slant rhyme or pararhyme or close rhyme or near rhyme or off rhyme or half rhyme or whatever it's called this week. Both poems, I suppose, could be claimed, exhibit organizing principles from which they are not afraid to depart. And both poems are animal poems, poems which delay the introduction of those animals until their closing passages. Bishop's titular species makes a brief three-line appearance between an owl and a rabbit, both of which command more column inches. Lowell's skunk, when it arrives, finally, is a far more conspicuous and flagrant presence in a poem whose direction of travel is towards the interior. From the sparsely populated coastline to an inland town and eventually into the head of the author, who at one point presents himself as a kind of peeping Tom or early Dogger, ogling lovers in their cars through the windscreen of his Tudor Ford. The devil has all the best lines, they say, and mature poets steal, says Eliot. Thus, at the moment Skunkhour turns in on itself, Lowell appropriates Satan's famous self-assessment, "Myself am hell," as rendered by Milton. In some respects, it's a moment of audacious, even absurd mimicry, and the absolute zenith of confessional narcissism, Lowell having the brass neck to compare his own mental turmoil with all the turmoil in the universe from the beginning of time until the end of eternity. That said, we might remember Milton wasn't beyond a little griping himself, and that even within the selfless masterpiece that is Paradise Lost, he still finds time in Book 3 to bemoan his loss of sight. Devastating for the author, of course, but in comparison to the fall of mankind, somewhat trivial. "I am the skunk," said Lowell in a letter to Bishop, identifying himself with the mother creature rummaging in the trash can in the final stanza, not unlike the manner the poet himself snooped around in his car at the top of the hill, grubby and shameless, feeding off the pleasures of others. My own response to the poem has always been to see the skunk, and especially the skunks of the previous stanza who march up Main Street with their eyes of red fire, as not so much Lowell, but his demons, an uncontrollable, unpredictable and unwelcome gaggle of troublesome creatures who emerge from the moonlight and do as they please, ransacking his thoughts and destroying his composure. By the end of the poem, something of an accommodation appears to have been arrived at, the poet on the back steps taking the air as the mother skunk plunders a discarded cup of sour cream. But the truce is an uneasy one, and it's the animal rather than the poet who will not scare. Lowell is not the armadillo of Bishop's poem, despite what some have thought, despite even what Lowell might have alluded to in an introspective, retrospective essay about Skunkhour, in which he talks about his earlier poems as prehistoric monsters wearing ponderous armour, and how reading Bishop had suggested a way of breaking through the shell of my own manner. The armadillo describes St. John's Day festival in Brazil, and the outlawed practice of releasing fire balloons into the night, forerunners of today's equally destructive paper lanterns, I imagine. I also imagine that in Bishop's Brazil, the illegality related to the combustibility of many dwellings and buildings at the time, though the poet's concern is primarily for the animals endangered by the falling balloons, one of which, she says, splattered like an egg of fire. It's a thought-provoking simile, given the phoenixes of late air, and one I think which combines the revelry and romance of the carnival, at least when the balloons go up like hearts, she says, with notions of aerial bombardment as they come down. The fire bombings of World War II, the nuclear strikes on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and the conflagrations of the Korean War all feel present in that image. Admittedly, the references are indirect to the point of sublimity, but that was Bishop's way. In the same way, her own ambiguous presence in the poem is incorporated into the words "we" and "our." She's not alone. The use of "us" in line 18 is more inclusive, more globally intentioned, but in a stanza in which a forsaking is taking place, and in which those heart-like balloons are not only receding and dwindling, but suddenly turning dangerous, their role as romantic signifiers can't properly be ignored. So if the skunk is Lowell, is Bishop the armadillo? Certainly she empathizes with the animal, and its habits as a creature feel commensurate with the poet's somewhat withdrawn and reclusive personality, both in relation to the world and the page. Hastily, all alone, a glistening armadillo left the scene, rose-flecked, head down, tail down. That's all we get of the creature, whose inconspicuousness in the world seems in direct proportion to its walk-on, i.e. walk-off, role in the poem. Except, of course, where it re-emerges in that enigmatic, rhetorical, and italicized final quatrain, in which a weak, mailed fist, clenched ignorant against the sky, is presumably the scaly paw of the animal, and the impassioned protest of the poet, and the ardent but ineffective remonstration of poetry itself. On this occasion, it feels as if the art of comparison is being called into question, the dream-like mimicry being too pretty. The weather bishop is complaining about the fire balloons and their hazardous attempts at representation, or Posey's misguided efforts in the field of imitation, or some failing on her own part in being beguiled by metaphor, I'm not certain. Like many of Bishop's poems, the armadillo turns away from resolution in its closing statement, preferring instead some more inscrutable expression or gnomic utterance, as if the signalling and semaphoring throughout had already done the work, after which a grand closing gesture would seem gratuitous or vulgar. Let's not forget that this was the poet who told us she celebrated winning the Pulitzer Prize with a couple of Oreo cookies in the empty house of a neighbour, and whose best memory of Yaddo, the legendary writer's retreat in Saratoga Springs, was a visit to the local racetrack where she watched grooms sweeping horse manure into brass dustpans. Bishop was adept at distraction and deflection, not only in interviews, but also in poems, especially towards the end of poems, where a reader's attention is often ushered away from any manufactured significance towards the incidental, the mundane, and the seemingly irrelevant. The majority of Elizabeth Bishop's work doesn't look or sound like the majority of Stevie Smith's work, but there are more than a handful of individual poems that have Smith-like qualities, especially some of the lighter and more playful, uncollected verses published posthumously in Edgar Allan Poe and the Jukebox. Poems like Close, Close All Night, and Keaton, and Mr. and Mrs. Carlyle, and The Soldier and the Slot Machine, which begins, I will not play the slot machine, don't force the nickel in my hand. I will not play the slot machine for all the nickels in the land. It's a comparison, or at least an equivalence, that extends to the lives of the two poets, Bishop and Smith, lives out of which the poems extend. Of the same generation, more or less, Smith being 9 years younger, both women were practicing poets during a century in which dramatic changes to the traditional structures of society were taking place. As writers, neither Bishop nor Smith were seen as operating in the vanguard of those changes, and both were reluctant in different ways to be categorized as women poets, though later appraisals identify strong feminist themes in their work. Both poets position themselves on the margins of poetic society and as outsiders to or independent of the metropolitan literati, and both have been claimed and acclaimed as gay poets, though again, this tends to be through retrospective consideration and interpretation rather than by declarations made by the poets themselves. Both Bishop and Smith suffered from respiratory problems, from psychological issues ranging from painful shyness to depression to nervous breakdown, and both were practitioners of the visual arts, Bishop having said on a number of occasions that she would have preferred to have been a painter, and Smith, of course, publishing her cartoon-like line drawings as illustrations to her poems, or vice versa. More significantly, presumably, and in a more striking parallel, both poets suffered parental abandonment. Bishop's father died when she was just 8 months old. Smith's father effectively deserted the family when she was 2 or 3. When Bishop was 5, her mother was hospitalized with mental health problems and soon afterwards committed to a sanatorium for the rest of her life, dying when Bishop was 23. Smith's mother died when Stevie was 16, and both poets were raised by their extended families. It's easy, of course, with hindsight, to play the part of the amateur psychologist, but naive not to acknowledge the importance of such emotional circumstance when it appears reflected in the work. One Art is probably Bishop's most recognised and anthologised poem, though personally, I don't feel it's an unqualified success. My problem is in the logic. Bishop's assertion that the art of losing isn't hard to master, and her conclusion that such losses are no disaster, being, in my view, two separate and non-contiguous positions. By which I mean, it would be perfectly possible to master the art of losing, but still find the consequences disastrous. I say this because I feel we're being encouraged to understand, through the example she gives, that Bishop's art of losing is an active one, like the art of stealing or the art of sleeping, whereas each section of the poem reflects not on the action, but of its consequences. What I think Bishop means, and what commentators allow for her, is that coming to terms with the effects of such loss is the thing which can be mastered. My point is nitpicky, hair-splitty, not absolutely watertight, and I'm sure a half-competent grammarian could mount a decent case for the defence. But it's important in the sense that we need to be confident about what is at stake here. Otherwise, how can we fully enjoy the deception and evasion that Bishop performs for us? One Art is a late poem, albeit one that underwent endless refinement, and carries a tone of summation, even finality. The poet apparently looking back at her life and dismissing the impact of loss with a somewhat jocular tone. But that breezy waving away of disaster is a conscious duplicity designed to alert us to the true heartbreak occasioned by accumulated losses, or losing, as Bishop has it. For one thing, it isn't humanly possible to suffer so repeatedly and on that scale without being significantly affected, is it? And for another, Bishop isn't capable of writing a mundane and vacuous poem whose response to a series of escalating bereavements amounts to little more than a cheery and banal, "Oh well, never mind." The language of the poem wears a brave face, but one we're expected to see through, and its declarations are deliberately half-hearted. So Bishop's career preference for ambiguity serves her well here, the easygoing, almost childlike tone of the language being immediately undermined by the rigid structures of the villanelle, a form whose repetitious nature implies fixation bordering on obsession. Other things to notice and admire include the pun of her mother's watch, especially in combination with her play on the word father in the previous stanza, and the word shan't, which introduces a calculated uncertainty to the poet's argument, theatrically distancing herself from the most recent or impending loss, with a somewhat decorous verbal gesture and a confusion of tenses. Finally, we encounter the checkered flag of that parenthetical, part italicized, part capitalized, and exclamation marked exhortation, write it. Wow. Meaning what? Advice to others? Another pun, as in make it right rather than stop getting it wrong? An encouraging instruction to the self? All three probably, and others besides, but most pertinently the latter, and relevant in this context for the way it falls between two instances of the word like. Because what it tells us about Bishop's attitude to analogy, if nothing else, is that the act or art of comparison is crucial enough to let a complex and contorted simile occupy the critical position in this crucial poem. And that things might be best observed, captured, or even understood in terms of what they may look like, i.e., with a sideways glance or in poetry's peripheral vision, as she once described it. Glimpses of what one can never see full face, but that seems enormously important. So that stuttering, hesitant and interrupted double use of like is actually a reinforcement, a confirmation of her true feelings about the power of loss and the power of metaphor in the form of a philosophical double negative. Across 19 lines, she claims a kind of emotional resilience while simultaneously conveying to us the insincerity of that claim. And likewise, in that final line, she apparently doubts the comparison between loss and disaster, even though disaster is exactly what it is. And for comparison's sake, I'll finish with Stevie Smith's poem Infelice, also a poem of deliberate self-deception in the territory of love. Also a poem which ends with the intention to commit thoughts to paper, and also a poem whose emotional locus might be found in its central simile, a man with a face like the sand, shifting, unreliable, never the same in the morning as it was at night. Walking swiftly with the dreadful Duchess, he smiled too briefly. His face was as pale as sand. He jumped into a taxi when he saw me coming, leaving me alone with a private meaning. He loves me so much, my heart is singing. Later at the club, when I rang him in the evening, they said, Sir Rat is dining, is dining, is dining. No, madam, he left no message. Ah, how his silence speaks. He loves me too much for words, my heart is singing. The Pullman seats are here, the tickets for Paris, I am waiting. Presently the telephone rings. It is his valet speaking. Sir Rat is called away to Scotland, his constituents. Ah, the dreadful Duchess, but he loves me best. Best pleasure to the last, my heart is singing. One night he came, it was 4 in the morning. Walking slowly upstairs, he stands beside my bed. Dear darling, lie beside me. It is too cold to stand speaking. He lies down beside me. His face is like the sand. He is in a sleep of love. My heart is singing. Sleeping softly, softly, in the morning I must wake him. And waking he murmurs, I only came to sleep. The words are so sweetly cruel. How deeply he loves me. I say them to myself alone. My heart is singing. Now the sunshine strengthens. It is 10 in the morning. He is so timid in love. He only needs to know. He is my little child. How can he come if I do not call him? I will write and tell him everything. I take the pen and write. I love you so much. My heart is singing. Thank you very much.